So good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming out this weekend to learn more about the teachings of Dogen Zenji, who established Soto Zen practice in Japan in the 13th century. And thank you for not being too intimidated by the idea of reading a Dogen text together. I think there's a tendency for people to think, oh, Dogen, I can't possibly, he's too difficult, this is too difficult for me. I don't want to get tangled up in trying to figure Dogen. I just want to sit. So I want to assure you that the main purpose of taking up this Dogen test is to support your sitting, to really get a sense of what it is to sit as Dogen sat, to just sit. The practice of shikantaza, just sitting, is so simple, and yet inexhaustible. So I'll say a few more words about that when we sit again. And as we go, everything that we look at this weekend is about how to sit and how to live our lives, just as they are in this world. As for reading Dogen, well, most of us have some kind of reading that we shy away from, you know, whether it's philosophy or physics or poetry or something else. And Dogen has elements of all three of those. His writing is paradoxical and poetic. It can make our head spin if we try to make sense of it in conventional, rational terms. But his message about our practice is radically simple and utterly relevant to how we live in the world, as I hope you'll come to appreciate this weekend. So we will be reading Dogen together. And although Michael talked about this being a silent retreat, and it mostly will be, we will also talk about Dogen, Dogen's teachings together. And engage with his words in different ways. So when we sit, we'll just sit, and we meet with each other in practice conversations, we'll do that in that same spirit of presence, full presence, as when we sit. But before we plunge in, I'll talk a little bit about Dogen's life, for those of you who may be new to him. He was born in Kyoto in the year 1200, a long time ago, into a high-ranking family of the nobility. It's believed that his father died when he was 2 and his mother when he was 8. This second loss affected him deeply. He's said to have received his first insight into the impermanence of all things as he saw the incense rise next to his mother's body. He chose to become a Buddhist monk when he was quite young, and he was ordained in the Tendai sect, which was dominant at that time. He trained at Enryaku-ji Monastery. Some of you went there on our last trip to Japan. Flo did, Lucille did, Todd did, yeah, and some of you will go on this next trip. It's a mountain. The monastery is on a mountain northeast of Kyoto, covered with heavy cedar forests. And to this day, the monks there, some of the monks there, undergo an austerity of marathon running. If you've heard of the marathon monks, that's where they are. But Dogen didn't do that. He learned the teaching there of original enlightenment, Hongaku, that this teaching that we all have Buddha nature. That enlightenment is not something out there in the far distant future that we have to work really hard to achieve. But that rather it is our essential nature is enlightened, is awakened. It's just obstructed by the many obstacles and delusions that arise in our lives by the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. So in response to this teaching about original enlightenment, as a teenager, you have to push back, right? So Dogen formed the question that became the central question, the central koan of his life. If we are already enlightened Buddhas, why do we have to practice so hard to become enlightened? And he felt that the practice, the Tendai practice, which didn't emphasize meditation much at all at that time, was not really helping him to answer that question. So when he was 17, he went to practice at a Rinzai called Kenji in Kyoto, where we'll go this May, that had been founded in 1202, so still quite recently, by Eisai, who was the first Japanese priest to bring Rinzai Zen from China to Japan. So Rinzai practice was established in Kyoto amongst the nobility. It was the samurai's sect, just a little bit before Soto Zen. Dogen practiced with Eisai's disciple Myozen as his teacher, and in 1223, the two of them traveled to China. So Dogen would have been 23. His teacher, Myozen, died there, and Dogen stayed on. For 5 years, he practiced with several Rinzai teachers, and eventually met the teacher he felt was his true teacher, Tiantong Rujing. He practiced with him for about 3 years. Rujing taught him a different perspective on practice and gave him Dharma transmission. Dogen returned to Japan and practiced. He went back to Kenin-ji, the Rinzai temple, for a few years, but the style of practice there no longer fit for him. So he moved to a hermitage in the hills on the outskirts of Kyoto, very near where Michael and I used to live. And there he wrote his first teaching text, Fukan Zazengi. That's the one that we all know, or we chant sometimes. It gives instructions for Zazen and includes the famous lines, think not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. And of course we all go, what does he mean by that? Sorry, for a moment I thought I hadn't pushed the button. People began to come to hear his teaching, to visit him in his little hermitage, and then in 1223, he founded his own monastery, Koshoji, which is gone now. That year, he wrote a commentary on the Heart Sutra, followed by Genja Koan, the text that we're going to explore today. So Dogen was only 33 when he wrote this text, but it lies at the core of his teaching. And many years later, before he died, he was only 53 when he died, but in those days, that was probably a pretty good lifespan. The year before he died, he compiled his masterwork called the Shobo Genzo. That's usually translated as the Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. And he rewrote Genjo Koan and put it as the very first chapter. There are different chapter counts. There's a 75 and a 95 chapter count, depending on which ones are included. When I was deciding what text to focus on in this retreat, I vacillated between choosing one that I'm less familiar with, one that's new to me and I want to explore. I've read quite a few, but I haven't read the whole Shobo Genzo yet, and there are some I'd like to explore. But then I thought about the Genjo Koan and how important it was, and particularly to people who are newer to Dogen. And I thought, well, what could I possibly have to say or add? It's the most commented upon writing of Dogen. So there's there's at least 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, probably one or two more English commentaries. So I was a bit intimidated. But it's kind of rite of passage for a Zen teacher to talk about Genjo Koan. Apparently, Suzuki Roshi, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, our Dharma great-great-grandfather at San Francisco Zen Center, gave a series of talks on it almost every year in the later part of his teaching time there. So I thought I would tackle it with your help. We'll do this together. And as I said, in this style of retreat, it won't be just me talking. So I hope that you'll actively engage with Dogen yourself and in dialogue with each other. Now, typically, a Soto Zen teacher takes the whole first talk just introducing the text and explaining the title. I hope I'll get a little further along than that. But first things first, the title. Genjo Koan, excuse me, has been translated in many ways. Taigen Dan Layton did the work for me of listing all the different translations he could find. That was in his introduction to this book, which has three translations of three commentaries by 20th century Japanese teachers. I'll come back to this. In his introduction, he lists these translations of Genjo Koan. The question of everyday life, actualizing the fundamental point, the realized law of the universe, manifesting absolute reality, actualization of enlightenment, manifesting suchness, living what is according with the truth. So that's, you get the gist. Those are all different ways of translating this, Genjo Koan. Let's look at these Chinese characters that make up the words. Michael made this up for us, and there's a copy for each of you on the shelf against the wall, if you'd like to have one. They're Xeroxed. They're not originals. But they look okay. Gen means to appear or to be in the present moment. This part of the character here is the character for to see, and that part is eye. This kind of eye that you see with, and this is to see. So to appear in the present moment. Jo is to become. So together, it means to manifest, to actualize in the present moment. And then koan. Koan we know from the classic Japanese teaching stories and questions, koans. Used particularly in Rinzai Zen as objects of meditation. Purposely to break through our sort of conventional dualistic thinking, to jolt us into an experience of awakening, or kensho. Kensho is the word that's used in Rinzai Zen a lot. Satori is another word for awakening that you've probably heard. An experience of opening to our boundless true nature, our Buddha nature. Dogen's writings are full of references to the classic Chinese koan literature. He assembled his own collection of 300 koans that he copied when he was in China and brought back to Japan. But he never wrote a commentary in the style of the other classic collections where the koan is followed by a commentary and a verse. He just collected these 300 koans, but his writings in Shobo Genzo are just full of koans, stories, and his commentary on them. We don't know exactly how Dogen used koans in his teaching. In terms of the only instructions for meditation that we have are those given in Shikantaza, Fukan Zazengi about Shikantaza, to sit upright, how to hold your hands, how to hold your feet, and think non-thinking. That's pretty much all he says about what to do with when you're actually sitting. So we have to go to his writings to get a sense of how we sit, how we just sit, what that means to him. The characters of koan are ko, this means public, public, and it also has the sense of equality or evenness. Equal before the law. It's a legal term, koan, and on. Means a proposition, a suggestion. So koan on a public proposition becomes a kind of case, like a legal case. And this word was adopted into Zen practice for these stories, these presentations that the teacher would present to a student, and the student would give a response. So Genjo Koan, rather than referring to a particular traditional koan, refers to the koan of our life, the fundamental koan of our life. How do we manifest our life fully in each moment? That's Dogen's fundamental question. So let's see what he has to say about it. You each have a copy of Genjo Koan. And I'm going to ask each of you, if you'd like, to take a turn reading passages. So is there someone who could read number one for us? Todd, thanks.
As all things are Buddha Dharma, there is delusion and realization, practice, birth, and death. And there are Buddhas and sentient beings. As the myriad things are without an abiding self, there is no delusion, no realization, no Buddha, no sentient being, no birth and death.
Thank you. So here Dogen is setting up what in Buddhist thought are called the two truths. We could call them unity and diversity, the one and the many, the absolute and the relative, or as in the Heart Sutra, we chant emptiness and form. The first sentence says that all phenomena exist within Buddha Dharma in their particularity, delusion and realization, practice, birth and death, Buddhas and sentient beings. These are pairs that seem like dualisms. But then in the second sentence, Dogen sees the same phenomena as having no abiding self, as being impermanent and not non-separate, only existing in relationship to birth, life, only really exists in relation to death. Delusion in relation to awakening. Buddhas and sentient beings only exist in relation to each other. So this reality is called emptiness. Emptiness, not in the sense of some void, but empty. Kaz Tanahashi has encouraged us to use the translation boundless rather than empty, because emptiness in English has the association of nihilism and despair. Whereas boundlessness is a good description for what this this reality really is. The boundlessness of all phenomena in space and time. So from that perspective, from the perspective of boundlessness, of unity, there is no delusion, no realization, no Buddha, no sentient beings, no birth and death. So this sounds like the Heart Sutra we chant, you know, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. So that's the perspective of oneness, of the absolute, of no separation. But these two truths, the one of oneness and particularity, are simultaneous. Let's read the... Could someone read the second section, please? Catherine? Yeah.
The Buddha way is, basically, leaving clear of the many and the one. Thus there are birth and death, delusion and realization, sentient beings and Buddhas. Yet in attachment, blossoms fall, and in aversion, weeds spread.
So here, he's describing leaping clear of the duality of the relative and the absolute. And when we leap clear of the duality, when we live in their simultaneous, in the simultaneous truth of the relative and the absolute, then existence is just as it is, unfolding from moment to moment, birth and death, delusion and realization, sentient beings and Buddhas. This is going to date me, but some of you may remember a song by the old folk singer Donovan. It goes, first there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. Does anybody remember that? So Donovan got that expression, first there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is, from Zen master Qingwan Weixin, who was translated by D.T. Suzuki, not Shunryu Suzuki, D.T. Suzuki, who was one of the first popularizers, translators and popularizers, and interpreters of Zen and Japanese culture in the West. He was never a priest, he was a lay practitioner in Rinzai Zen. And he translated Weixin, who said, before I had studied Chan, or Zen, for 30 years, I saw mountains as mountains and rivers as rivers. When I arrived at a more intimate knowledge, I came to the point where I saw that mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers. So that's first he was seeing the relative, then he was seeing the absolute. But now that I have got its very substance, I am at rest, for it's just that I see mountains once again as mountains and rivers once again as rivers. So seeing phenomena as they are, which is always changing, always interconnected. But he's seeing the particularity in the unity. So from this perspective, we don't get stuck. We don't get stuck in the relative or the absolute. We don't get stuck in form or in emptiness. And yet, and this is a big and yet, in attachment, blossoms fall, and in aversion, weeds spread. We lose what we love, and we get more and more of what we don't want. Right? But if we see deeply into this reality, we begin to see a beauty in the fallen blossoms. Dignity in the lightning-struck tree. We see the exquisite patterns of the weed leaves or flowers as we pull them from our garden. And the elegance of slugs. You may not agree with me on this one, but as we pluck them from our broccoli with our chopsticks. I was gesturing like this, but no. I put them in a yogurt container and then I relocate them across the road into the ditch. Okay, you might say, it's one thing in the garden, but what about the cancer that devastates the body of a loved one, or the drunk driver who kills our child? Are we expected to take that with equanimity, dispassion? Well, some Buddhist doctrine might be interpreted that way and has been. But Dogen is going radically further here. He's saying we must include even our grief, even our rage, within the scope of our Dharma eye. This too arises. This too passes. The Japanese have cultivated an aesthetic that includes and appreciates decay, withering, imperfection. There are words for this. In Japanese, the word aware. It's spelled like aware, A-W-A-R-E, but it's aware. Is the poignant beauty of what is impermanent. Cherry blossoms are the quintessence of aware. As some of you know, quite a long time ago now, in 1990, I was with my younger sister, who died in Japan after a bout of very aggressive lymphoma. And it was in April when the cherry blossoms were falling. So the aware of cherry blossoms is not an abstract concept for me. Every year, it's there. Another word is wabi. Wabi is a word that refers to the austere beauty of rustic, worn, or aged things. This is not a quality that is very highly valued in our throwaway culture. Can an iPhone be wabi? Actually, I think I've seen one that came close. A related word from the aesthetic of haiku poetry is sabi. All of these are words from haiku and Japanese poetry. Sabi. Sabi is beauty tinged with loneliness and awareness of the transient nature of all things. Sabi is also the word for rust, so that patina of age, of decay. The haiku poet Basho wrote many haiku on loneliness. It was a central theme in his life. Ukiware o sabishigaraseo, kankodori. This wandering life, cuckoo calling deep in the forest, deepens my loneliness. Now in Japanese, the word cuckoo doesn't have a silly meaning that it does in English. It's actually a very evocative, haunting call. So when Basho wrote these haiku about loneliness, was he somehow failing in his Zen practice because he felt lonely? Or did he express his life just as it was, in that haiku moment, with a kind of integrity and lack of pretense? And then he made an offering of that experience in a poem. It's a little different from indulging and hanging on to a state of loneliness. In haiku practice, as in Zen practice, our karmic patterns arise and become grist for the mill. With clear seeing, they are purified. We let go even momentarily of our constant grasping, our constant gauging, weighing of whether this event or object or person is good or bad for us. Let's go back to Dogen. Tim, could you read number 3?
To carry yourself forward and experience myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and experience themselves as awakening. Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. Further, there are those who continue realizing beyond realization, who are in delusion throughout delusion. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. However, they are actualized Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddhas.
Okay. What shall we do with that? So the first sentence describes our usual mode of living. Right, we carry ourselves forward. We're in the driver's seat, steering our way through life, and seeing everything else as outside us. We are either attracted or repelled or indifferent to the objects of our attention. This is delusion, Dogen says. On the other hand, when we directly experience and meet the myriad things coming forward to meet us, this is awakening. I like that Chinese expression. In Japanese, Bampo means 10,000 dharmas. It means everything, all the things we meet in our life, or each thing is a dharma. That's a different use of the word dharma. It means a manifestation, a phenomenon. The number of 10,000, of course, stands for countless phenomena. Sentient and insentient beings passing in and out of existence all the time, within and around us. But Dogen doesn't let us stop there. He goes on to say, those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. This is vintage Dogen. He loves to use language to subvert language, to turn around our conventional understandings, our tidy dualisms. He's saying, I think, that when we include within the range of our Dharma eye a clear view of the arising of delusion in our karmic lives, this too is awakening. When we first sit down and start to pay attention to our lives, what do we see? What a mess we are. People come after practicing for a while and they say, oh, I don't know, I feel like I'm getting worse instead of better because I just see all my delusions. And we usually say, that's great. It just means you're paying attention before you are oblivious. Hang in there. Stay steady. Keep paying attention. So of course, what else can we see but how deluded we are? What he doesn't say here is that through this seeing, wisdom and compassion arise together. But it's very clear from his writings as a whole that this is what he believes. Then he cautions us that those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. As soon as we stop to pat ourselves on the back for having some experience of awakening, we've already separated ourselves from our life. We're already back in delusion. Bokusan Nishiyari was a renowned Zen teacher of the early 20th century, and his commentary is one of the three in this book. The other two are Suzuki Roshi, who we know well, and Uchiyama Roshi, who is another wonderful Japanese Zen teacher I'll mention later, from the mid-20th century. And Nishiyari Roshi has these colorful words to say about being greatly deluded about realization. He says, it's not good to say, look, I'm okay because I'm enlightened. And to proclaim, as Rinzai Linji said, the entire canon is just old pieces of toilet paper. Meaning, if you're enlightened, all the sutras are of no use at all. If you are enlightened to that extent, you don't need to use such dusty old crinkle paper for wiping. It's better to use soft paper for wiping. That is self-inflated enlightenment. It's far from actualizing Buddha. I had to really chuckle when I read this because I actually remember that dusty crinkle paper. Mm-hmm. Don't you, Michael?
Oh, yeah.
When we were in Japan. We would encounter it occasionally in the more rustic locations. where we traveled, most often in public washrooms, there was no toilet paper. So you always had to carry your little, you know, packages of tissue. And those, you'd get these little packages of tissue at street corners. They'd be handed out with advertising on them. So you always had some on hand, you hoped. And when we go to Japan now, it's kind of disappointing that you don't get your little free Kleenexes anymore, because washrooms are well equipped. They're state of the art now. So Nishiari Hoshi is saying, if you're making a show that you're so enlightened you're indifferent to rough toilet paper, well. He also says, to regard one person's one-time experience of realization as enlightenment is absolutely demonic. When we have true enlightenment, there is not even a speck of what you thought was enlightenment. So, you know, in the West, I think we kind of latched on, and D.T. Suzuki was partly responsible for this, latched on to an idea of enlightenment as this one-time fireworks bonanza experience, and that after that, life would be, you know, after you achieve that, life would be just a piece of cake. And it just doesn't work that way. To relate, this relates to Dogen's statement in this passage. Further, there are those who continue realizing beyond realization, and those who are in delusion throughout delusion. So he's saying there's no end point to enlightenment, and there's no end point to delusion. Right? They arise endlessly in human life. And enlightenment is not something we can possess or achieve as individuals. Even if we do have a profound experience of opening, we still live in this world of suffering. We have to come back and find a way to live and go forward in this world. This, if you were going to read one book, one commentary on Genjo Koan, I would recommend this one. It's called Realizing Genjo Koan, and it's by Shohaku Okumura, who's a contemporary Zen teacher, and he was Michael's and my first teacher in Japan. So he's very dear to us. He teaches in Bloomington, Indiana now. And he's done a lot of translating and teaching. He's just saturated in Dogen. So this is a really helpful resource. And here's his kind of paraphrasing of what Dogen says, that all beings are born within the network of interdependent origination. Interdependent origination, the Vietnamese Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh calls it interbeing, right? It's that matrix of existence within which our lives arise and pass away. All beings are born within the network of interdependent origination that is itself great realization, that is itself prajna, wisdom. Buddha ancestors and all of us are born, live, and die within this great realization. Our practice is to realize great realization within this great realization, moment by moment. Or perhaps it is better to say that great realization realizes great realization through our practice. In other words, we're manifesting what is true. Enlightenment is boundless, delusion is boundless. There are those who are in delusion throughout delusion. After a profound Kensho or Satori experience, delusion may arise again in many subtle and not so subtle ways. I mean, we've certainly heard examples of not only Zen but other Buddhist teachers who behave in harmful ways, probably because they thought they were enlightened and were somehow exempt from delusion. Even the most distinguished Zen teachers will admit, if they are honest, that delusion still arises. Not being a distinguished Zen teacher, it's easy for me to say that delusion still arises. Nishiari Roshi says, we do need a place to enter at the beginning where we have great realization of delusion. We do need to see deeply how suffering arises in our lives. But if you stop there, he says, you will have the disease of enlightenment. So whatever enlightenment you have, you should let go of all traces of that enlightenment. Dogen says, when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. However, they are actualized Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddhas. When you're completely present, fully engaged, right, you're not congratulating yourself that you're a Buddha. You're just manifesting 100%. And when we live in that way, we have the effect of drawing forth in others that Buddha nature. And that's where he says, they are actualized Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddhas, because we're connected to each other. And we are actualized by others as well. Okay, this first talk is going to be longer. The later ones will be shorter, because we just have to kind of launch this endeavor. Let's do a little more. Lucille, could you read the fourth section, please?
When you see forms or hear sounds, fully engaging body and mind, you grasp things directly. Unlike things and their reflections in the mirror, and unlike the moon and its reflection in the water, when one side is illuminated, the other side is dark.
So this passage is, I found, particularly tricky. Different commentaries explain it differently, or kind of bypass it. I found Suzuki Roshi refreshingly honest when he says, these three lines are impossible. You cannot do anything with them. So seeing forms, hearing sounds, fully engaging body and mind, grasping things directly without any idea of enlightenment or delusion, Suzuki Roshi says, that's the practice we come back to over and over again. Shohaku, in his commentary, says, in Zazen, our practice is to let go of our fabricated mental map. To let go of our fabricated mental map. Right? All that has conditioned our bodies and minds over the years. To open the hand of thought and thereby sit down on the ground of reality. Opening the hand of thought is an expression I really love and find so helpful when I'm, you know, that grip is tightening. And the expression was coined by Shohaku's teacher, Uchiyama Roshi, who's one of the three in this book, who was a wonderful, wonderful teacher. I guess when we were there, he was still alive, but he'd retired and he wasn't actively teaching. Opening the hand of thought means we don't have to try to manipulate our thoughts. We just release our grip on them and see them for what they are, conditioned and impermanent. This ground of reality we sit down on is not solid ground, but it's boundless, dynamic, and it's vast enough to release our anguish into. In our conventional way of seeing and experiencing the world, we're separate from the objects of perception. We can see the moon's reflection in the pond, or the moon itself, but we can't see both at the same time. I don't think. That's what Shohaku suggests this passage is saying. I'll have to try it sometime. Can you see the moon? Actually, you can, in the ocean. Yeah. Anyway, you know, we try. Everybody's really grappling with this one little passage about the moon, because it seems like he's using it in a different way than he uses the moon and reflection metaphor later in the text. So it's tough. But we'll play along with him. When he says, when one side is illuminated, the other side is dark. And here, he's kind of saying, when we see only the particularity of things, we lose sight of the interconnection, the vastness of things. We talked about the relative and the absolute. Typically in Buddhist thought, the light and dark are used to represent those two truths. In the light, we can see detail, so that's the relative, we can see the relative world. In the dark, everything vanishes and becomes one. You probably know these lines from one of the chants we use regularly, harmony of difference and equality. In the light, there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark, there is light, but don't see it as light. So it's that Taoist yin-yang symbol, right? With the little dot of black on the white side and the little dot of white on the black side. Our practice is not to get stuck in the light or in the darkness. What that means is sometimes right in the middle of our suffering or our delusion, the whole sky turns and we open. And we experience, boundlessness. And in that opening arises the heart of wisdom and the heart of compassion together. The whole sky turning, it's a Dogen phrase, and I can't place where it is, but it's what my teacher, Norman Fisher, wrote on the back of my first rakusu that I sewed. So it's a phrase that's important to me, the whole sky turning. And it can turn in any moment. So I'm going to stop talking. And I'm going to ask you all to take out your pens and paper and look back over this passage, as far as we went now. And just mark anything that kind of resonated for you, that felt like you could, you know, it would resonate with your own practice. And then make another mark for something that maybe was like particularly obscure or difficult. Take a few minutes to do that, and then I'm going to give you another suggestion. This one. Part two is to just reflect on your own experience and see if you can summon up or remember an experience of being stuck in the relative, stuck in the particular, and experiencing a shift of an opening where the Dharma eye opens. And it's not that you're not still in pain, but you experience it differently. Sometimes anger just dissolves when that happens. That shift. See if you can think of a time that happened. And then part three, I'm going to go ahead and say this one too. This is optional, but if you would like to try and write a haiku. Okay, a haiku is a moment, they're called haiku moments, a moment of self-meeting world, just as it is. And so, in that, and then offering it, writing it down, and in doing that, we turn it. Even if the experience is kind of unpleasant. I mean, Basho wrote a great haiku about laying in there was no room in the inn, so he lay in a shed, and right beside his pillow he heard the sound of the horse pissing. And he wrote a haiku about it. He just used, and then he wrote exquisitely beautiful ones as well, right? Okay, so that's part three, write a haiku. So take a few more minutes to kind of